He shares an appreciation of the whimsical world of entertainment with his eldest son, Kim Jong-nam, who recently flew to Japan, desperate to visit the new Japanese Disney World. He used a fake Dominican Republic passport, sure, he looks Dominican, to try to gain entry to the country. When immigration realized who he was, they called his daddy and had him sent back to his room in North Korea. Kim Jong-il reportedly receives blood transfusions from young virgins on a regular basis to slow the aging process. He is also an avid sports fan and fully understands the difference between zone and man-to-man defense in American basketball. He wears platform shoes to increase his height and is rumored to be the largest individual purchaser of Hennessy cognac in the world. The problem is millions of people are starving to death in North Korea, mostly because Kim Jong-il is also a dictator who spends 25% of his country's GNP on the military. Now, you can get away with that if you're an American. I mean, we've got a lot of amber waves of grain, so we won't all starve giving the majority of our money to the Pentagon. But in North Korea, a rocky peninsula with lots of snails, you just can't operate from that scenario. Since 1948, when the Korean Peninsula was divided into the Communist North and Capitalist Fascist South, the citizens of both Koreas have endured harsh conditions. They've lived through the Korean War, which never officially ended. We're still in ceasefire mode. Decades of repression and isolation, which for South Korea ended with the pro-democracy movement of the 1980s, but for North Korea continues today. Economic deprivation, floods, and famine. North Koreans have only been allowed reunions with family members from South Korea twice in more than 50 years. In 1985, just 50 people from each side were allowed to meet with their relatives, and in August of 2000, 100 more were permitted reunions. Kim Jong-il, referred to in North Korea as Dear Leader, has a reputation for being an eccentric, irresponsible playboy. The assessment a couple of years ago was of a drunken kook who didn't understand the world around him, a former senior Clinton official has said. After he succeeded his father, who ruled the country from 1948 to 1994, as the country's official leader, Kim was accused of being responsible for the bombing deaths of several members of the South Korean cabinet and for the explosion of a South Korean civilian airliner. He has a huge army and is even suspected of having the atomic bomb. In the past 2 years, though, Kim Jong-il has begun showing signs of a change of heart, signs that he's emerging from the shadows. When the famine began in 1995, Kim refused to allow foreign aid workers free access to the countryside and had some food aid diverted to the army. But last year, he allowed almost 150 representatives of international governmental organizations to set up camp in North Korea. He recently hosted a summit with the president of South Korea, who has been encouraging North Korea to end its dangerous isolation. Then Kim even allowed a visit from U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, who found him capable of having serious diplomatic discussions. They actually hit it off quite well. He dragged her to a bunch of events, shows, dinners, and movies. And now that Kim is getting in the groove and realizing, like me, that sitting in a dark theater watching all kinds of movies can be the road to peace and tranquility. He allegedly had two film producers kidnapped from South Korea to make documentaries in North Korea. I have a number of ideas that may help the wacky dictator save his country from total destruction. Watch better movies. Kim Jong-il has got to broaden himself past the porn and John Wayne. He once remarked that he was so moved by the performance of Leonardo DiCaprio that he probably could not bear to watch Titanic a second time. We understand. Here's a list of tapes I plan to send to him instead for his viewing pleasure. Easy Rider. The first thing Dear Leader needs to do is loosen up. This movie ought to help. 200 Motels. If Dennis Hopper can't do the trick, Frank Zappa will. Dude, Where's My Car? All you need to know about America is contained in this movie. My Dinner with Andre. Sure, it's just two guys eating and talking for 2 hours, but at least he'll get to see what a real meal looks like. The dinner conversation will help him refine his communication skills. Bring him to Hollywood for his own pitch meeting. He must have thousands of ideas for movies. One of them will surely be right for Rob Schneider. Tell the dictator we'll get Tom Cruise to play him in his life story, Long John Gone. Give him a first-look deal and a bungalow on the studio lot. Fill up his day with needless mergers with development executives and talent agents. That should keep him busy for a couple of years. By that time, North Korea should benefit from his absence and pull itself out of its slump. If all else fails, finance a theme park in Pyongyang. Theme parks always work. Even if they don't restore an economy, at least they make people feel good. Especially dear leader's Dominican son. And isn't that what really matters? Make him assistant manager. Chapter 9. One Big Happy Prison.
Can I read you something from my book here? It was a few minutes after 10 p.m. on October 4th, 2000, 1 month before the presidential election. The previous night, the first of three debates between Al Gore and George W. Bush had taken place. On this balmy October evening in Lebanon, Tennessee, John Adams, 64, had just sat down in his favorite tan recliner to watch the evening news. His cane, the result of a stroke a few weeks earlier, rested beside him. A well-respected member of Lebanon's African-American community, Adams was now on disability after working for years at the Precision Rubber Plant. The anchors on TV were dishing out their postmortems on the debate. Adams and his wife, Laureen, were discussing their intention to vote for Al Gore when there was a knock at the door. Mrs. Adams left the room, came to the door, and asked who was there. Two men demanded that she open the door and let them in. She asked again who they were, but they refused to identify themselves. She again refused to open the door. At that moment, two unidentified officers from the Lebanon Police Department's Drug Task Force broke down the door, grabbed Mrs. Adams, and immediately handcuffed her. Seven other officers burst into the house. Two of them ran around the corner into the back room, guns drawn, and pumped several bullets into John Adams. 3 hours later, he was pronounced dead at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. The raid on the Adams house had been ordered after an undercover informant purchased drugs in the house at 1120 Joseph Street. Lebanon's narcotics unit, funded along with thousands of others around the country as part of the Clinton administration's war on drugs, obtained warrants from a local judge to arrest the occupants of the house. The only problem, the Adamses live at 70 Joseph Street, not 1120. The drug war police had the wrong house. A few miles down the road in Nashville, as John Adams was being accidentally executed, scores of paid and volunteer staff bustled about inside Al Gore's national campaign headquarters. Their main concern that night was damage control, as they tried to distract voters from the spectacle of their candidate sighing through Bush's responses the previous night. On the table sat copies of Gore's anti-crime proposals, Fight the Drug War. None of them knew that their out-of-control efforts to eradicate drugs had just cost them a potential voter, that of an elderly black man across town. Killing off your voters is no way to win an election. This was one of just too many incidents in the past years where innocent people had been shot by local or federal drug police who thought that they had their man. But forget for a moment about helping the less fortunate. Who was the genius in the Clinton-Gore administration who said, hey, I've got an idea. Why don't we go after the black and Hispanic community? Plenty of drug users there. Lock them up in record numbers, and that will decimate the voting power of a group that votes for our side most of the time. It doesn't make sense, does it? What kind of campaign would purposely destroy its own voting base? You don't see the Republicans sitting around trying to plot ways to incarcerate corporate executives or NRA members. Trust me, you won't see Karl Rove convening a White House meeting to figure out a way to lock up and strip the voting rights from a million members of the Christian Coalition. But that's what the Clinton-Gore administration did. They saw that a million people more than when they were first in office, were sent to prison.
The Bush people are committed to seeing that none of their supporters ever enjoys the hospitality of a prison shower room. Much was made after Clinton left office of the pardons he granted to dubious fat cats like Mark Rich. The entire country was up in arms over the absolution given to a fugitive who got away without paying his taxes. A rich person who got away without paying taxes. We were shocked. Shocked! And yet no attention at all was paid to the pardons of David Lamp, Vincent Mitlicky, John Wadsworth, or James Weathers, Jr. And no one called for a congressional investigation of why criminal charges were dropped against Koch Industries, the largest privately held oil company in America, whose CEO and vice presidents are the brothers Charles and David Koch. Why was this? Because those pardons came during the reign of George W. Bush. In September 2000, the federal government brought a 97-count indictment against Koch Industries and its four employees, Lamp, Mietlicki, Wadsworth, and Weathers, who were Koch's environmental and plant managers, for knowingly releasing 91 metric tons of benzene, a cancer-causing agent, into the air and water, and for covering up the deadly release from federal regulators. This wasn't Koch's first run-in with the law. It wasn't even their first that year. Earlier, in 2000, Koch had been fined $35 million for illegal pollution in six states. But with the George W. Bush's election decided, Koch's fortunes suddenly changed. Koch executives had just contributed some $800,000 to Bush's presidential campaign and other Republican candidates and causes. In January, as John Ashcroft waited in the wings, the government dropped the charges first from 97 to 11 and then to a mere 9. Koch Industries, however, still faced fines totaling $352 million. Bush's new administration, now firmly in place, quickly fixed that. In March, they dropped two more charges. Then, 2 days before the case was to go to court, Ashcroft's Justice Department settled the case. Koch Industries pled guilty to a new charge of falsifying documents, and the government dropped all environmental charges against the company, including all felony counts against their four employees. Following hard on the heels of their generosity, the Koch executives facing possible prison terms were freed from any prosecution. The company itself had all 90 of the serious counts against it dismissed, and in the end paid a fine that wiped out the seven remaining counts. According to the Houston Chronicle, Koch executives celebrated the conclusion of the case, company spokesman Jay Rosser crowing about how the dropping of charges was proof of Koch's vindication. I won't defend the actions of Mark Rich, but correct me if I'm wrong. I believe the willful spewing into the air and water of a deadly chemical that causes cancer, and will surely contribute to who knows how many people's deaths, is a little more serious than skipping out on Rudy Giuliani to go on an 18-year ski trip to Switzerland. Yet I'm sure none of you have heard the pardons granted to Charles and David Koch and their oil company and its executives. Why should you? It was just business as usual, under a national press that's thoroughly asleep at the wheel. It's too bad that Anthony Lamar Taylor forgot to send in his contribution to the Bush campaign. Taylor was another repeat offender, a petty thief who decided one day in 1999 to pretend he was golf superstar Tiger Woods. Though Taylor looked nothing at all like Woods, but hey, they all look alike, don't they? He was able to use a fake driver's license and credit cards identifying him as Tiger Woods to purchase a 70-inch TV, a few stereos, and a used luxury car. Then somebody finally figured out he wasn't Tiger Woods, and he was arrested and tried for theft and perjury. His sentence? 200 years to life. You heard it right. 200 years to life, thanks to California's three strikes law, which says that upon a third criminal conviction, you're put away for life. To date, no corporate executive has been sent away for life after being caught three times polluting a river or ripping off its customers. In America, We reserve that special treatment for those who happen to be poor or African American, or fail to contribute to one of our fine political parties.
Sometimes the justice system, ever the steamroller, is so hell-bent on punishing the have-nots, it doesn't care who it locks up, guilty or not. Carrie Sanders, the youngest child of 9, suffered from paranoid schizophrenia. By the age of 27, he had fought the demons in his mind for over 7 years and had been in and out of mental institutions for much of that time. Sometimes, when he went off his medication, he would end up on the streets of Los Angeles, as he did one day in October 1993. While sleeping on a bench outside the USC Medical Center, Carrie was arrested for trespassing. But Carrie's luck turned worse when a routine warrant check showed that one Robert Sanders, a career criminal, had escaped 5 weeks earlier from a New York State prison where he was serving time for attempting to kill a man over cocaine in 1990. Of course, Carrie Sanders, now not Robert Sanders, Carrie Sanders of California, wasn't the Robert Sanders of New York. But I guess Carrie and Robert are close enough, and California and New York, well, they're both big states. Unfortunately for Carrie, what he did share with Robert was a birthday. That was enough for the L.A. cop, even though the same computerized warrant search showed that Carrie Sanders had been stopped for jaywalking on a Los Angeles street in July of 93, while Robert Sanders was still in his New York prison. No matter, Carrie Sanders was sent to New York to serve out Robert Sanders' sentence. He remained in the New York penitentiary for 2 years while his mother searched all over Los Angeles for him. Somehow the LA cops failed to compare the two records, which would have revealed that their guy had the wrong fingerprints. Carrie had only one person in the whole process who was supposed to help him, the public defender appointed to protect his interests. But this 30-year veteran of the public defender's office encouraged Carrie not to fight extradition. The public defender explained to Carrie that fighting back would only prolong his stay in LA. Apparently, the public defender didn't even notice that Carrie was slow, much less suffering from severe mental illness. Or would it have even mattered? The public defender failed to ask basic questions. He failed to spend more than a brief few minutes with this helpless client. He never looked into whether Carrie had any family that could be contacted to assist in his defense. The public defender also failed to check the system for any pending cases or a prior record or the client's financial status. He didn't even take the time to match the description on the warrant with Carrie, much less demand a fingerprint or a booking photo comparison. So what, you say? After all, both men were black. They were both the same age. They even had the same birthday. Isn't that good enough to lock somebody up in America? It gets worse. During the hearing to waive Carrie Sanders' right to fight the New York extradition, he was asked to sign a form. The form read, "I, Robert Sanders, do hereby freely and voluntarily state that I am the identical Robert Sanders." And then Carrie signed it, Carrie Sanders. He also drew doodles all over one copy of the waiver. No bells, no red flags, not for this public defender. Finally, given his chance to appear before a judge, Carrie was asked if he had read the document that he had just signed. He said he had not. The judge stopped this extraordinary proceeding. "Did you sign it?" asked the judge. "Yeah," Carrie replied. "Why did you sign it?" "Because they told me to," is what he said. All on the record. Carrie's public defender was ordered by the judge to review the form again with his client. Within minutes, the judge was satisfied that both the court and the public defender moved and then moved on to the next case. Well, after Carrie Sanders was sold down the river by his L.A. public defender, he was shipped across the country to spend the rest of those 2 years in the Green Haven Maximum Security Prison, 60 miles north of New York City, where he was sexually assaulted by other inmates. In October of 1995, after federal agents in Cleveland arrested the real Robert Sanders, Carrie Sanders was reunited with his mother, Mary Sanders Lee. Had it not been for the chance arrest of Robert Sanders, Kerry Sanders would still be in prison. Folks, this is not a rare case of the system making a horrible mistake. In a sense, it is not even a mistake. It is the natural result of a society that recklessly locks up anyone who may be a criminal, even if they aren't a criminal, because it's better to be safe than it is to be right. Well, this is America. I guess if it's good enough to remove thousands of innocent black men from the voting rolls in Florida, it should be good enough to railroad an innocent black man in Los Angeles. In this assembly line system of justice, the one thing that mucks up the wholesale delivery of the accused getting to jail is the jury trial. Why? Because jury trials are shit disturbers. They force everyone to do their job. The judges, the prosecutors, the public defenders do everything in their power to coerce the defendant into accepting a guilty plea to avoid the brutal prison sentence we will give you if you demand a jury trial. If they can get the defendant not only to plead guilty, but to also sign a waiver of his right to appeal, they've then hit a home run, and everyone can laugh about it later at the country club. My sister Anne was a public defender in California. She insisted on defending her clients and getting them a jury trial if that's what they wanted. For that, she was subjected to incredible harassment from the other public defenders in the office. In 1998, the public defender's office in her county allowed only one felony client out of almost 900 defendants to have a jury trial. One out of 900 got a jury trial. Obviously, that didn't mean every single one of the other 899 accused were guilty. They were just coerced into pleading that way, with many of them ending up in prison, perhaps for crimes they didn't commit. But we'll never know, because their Sixth Amendment right to a trial by jury of their peers was taken away from them. With this standardized railroading of the poor going on every day in every city in America, our justice system has nothing to do with justice. Our judges and our lawyers are more like glorified garbage men, rounding up and disposing of society's refuse, ethnic cleansing, American style. What happens when this fast-track shoot sends innocent people to their death? It took only one college class full of kids at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, to uncover and prove that five individuals on Illinois' death row were in fact innocent. Those students and their professor saved the lives of five people. If one college class could do that, how many other hundreds of innocent people on death row across America are also sitting there tonight, awaiting their permanent disposal?
Thirty-eight states have the death penalty. So does the federal government and the U.S. military. 12 states, plus the District of Columbia, that little piece of swampland with a majority of African Americans and those offensive license plates, do not. Since 1976, there have been over 700 executions in the United States. The top execution-happy states are Texas, 248 executions. Nearly one-third of all U.S. executions since 1976. Virginia, 82. Florida, 51. Missouri, 50. Oklahoma, 43. Louisiana, 26. South Carolina, 25. Arkansas, 24. Alabama, 23. Arizona, 22. North Carolina, 17. Delaware, 13. Illinois, 12. California, 9. Nevada, 9. Indiana, 8. Utah, 6. A shocking recent death penalty study of 4,578 cases in a 23-year period, 1973 to 1995, concluded that the courts found serious, reversible error in nearly 7 of every 10 capital sentence cases that were fully reviewed during the period. It also found that death sentences were being overturned in 2 out of 3 appeals. The overall prejudicial review error rate was 68%. Since 1973, some 95 death row inmates have been fully exonerated by the courts. That is, found innocent of the crimes for which they were sentenced to die. 96 persons have been released as a result of DNA testing. And what were the most common errors? One, egregiously incompetent defense lawyers who didn't even look for or missed important evidence that would have proved innocence or demonstrated that their client didn't deserve to die. Two, police or prosecutors who did discover that kind of evidence but suppressed it, actively derailing the judicial process. In half the years studied, including the most recent one, the error rate was over 60%. High error rates exist across the country. In 85% of death penalty cases, the error rates are 60% or higher. Three-fifths have error rates of 70% or higher. Catching these errors takes time. A national average of 9 years from death sentence to execution. In most cases, death row inmates wait years for the lengthy review procedures needed to uncover all these errors, whereupon their death sentences are very often reversed. This imposes a terrible cost on taxpayers, victims' families, the judicial system, and the wrongly condemned. Among the inmates involved in the study who had their death verdicts overturned, nearly all were given a sentence less than death, 82%, and many were found innocent on retrial, 7%. The number of errors has risen since 1996, when President Clinton made it tougher for death row inmates to prove their innocence by signing into law a one-year limit on the time inmates have to appeal to federal courts after exhausting their appeals in state courts. In light of the study that proved how many of these inmates are either innocent or not legally deserving of the death penalty, this attempt to curb their appeals was simply outrageous. We are one of the few countries in the world that puts to death both the mentally retarded and juvenile offenders. The United States is among the only six countries that impose the death penalty on juveniles. The others are Iran, Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen. The United States is also the only country besides Somalia that has not signed the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. Why? Because it contains a provision prohibiting the execution of children under 18. And we want to remain free to execute our children. No other industrialized nation executes its children. Even China prohibits the death penalty for those under 18. This from a country that has shown an intolerable lack of respect for human rights. Currently, the total number of death row inmates in the United States tops 3,700. 70 of those death row inmates are minors, or were when they committed their crime. But our Supreme Court doesn't find it cruel and unusual punishment, in the terms of the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution, to execute those who were 16 years old when they committed a capital crime. This despite the fact that same court has ruled that 16-year-olds do not have the maturity or judgment to sign contracts. Odd, isn't it, that a child's diminished capacity for signing contracts is viewed as a legal barrier to enforcing a contract, but when it comes to the right to be executed, a child's capacity is equal to that of an adult. 18 states allow juvenile offenders as young as 16 to be executed. 5 others allow the execution of those who were 17 or older when they committed their crime. In 1999, Oklahoma executed Sean Sellers, who was 16 at the time of the murders he was found guilty of committing. Sellers' multiple personality disorder wasn't revealed to the jury that convicted him. A federal appeals court found that Sellers might have been factually innocent because of his mental disorder, but that innocence alone is not sufficient to grant federal relief. Unbelievable. The American public is not stupid. And now that the truth has been coming out about the innocent people who have been sent to death row, they are at least responding with a sense of shame. Just a few years ago, public opinion polls showed that upwards of 80% of the American people supported the death penalty. But now, with the truth out, a recent Washington Post ABC News poll found that public approval of capital punishment has declined, while the proportion of Americans who favor replacing the death penalty with life in prison has increased. 51% favored halting all executions until a commission is established to determine whether the death penalty is being administered fairly. 68% said the death penalty is unfair because innocent people are sometimes executed.